Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent, and provocative discussion of issues every week as seen through the lens of sustainability. It is brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. It is hosted by Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher, and joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene. Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, broadcast every week on Otago Access Radio, and podcast on sustainablelens.org and on oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Each week we talk with someone making a positive difference, and we try to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens is that of Batya Friedman from the University of Washington Information School. I've been trying to organise this conversation for several years. In fact, since before she won the Sig Chi Social Impact Award in 2012 for her work on value-sensitive design, amongst other things. Thank you very much for joining me.
Oh, my pleasure.
So where'd you grow up?
L.A.
Which bit?
Oh, in the Valley. An original Valley girl.
What's it? I have a concept of the Valley, but I don't actually know what it's like.
Yeah, flat, hot, surrounded by mountains.
Suburbs.
Lots of suburbs. Yeah, originally lots of orchards, but by the time I got there, suburbs.
And lots of suburbs the same?
Oh, very much the same, yes.
And did you have a plan to get out of the Valley, or are you happy there?
Well, I did, in fact, immigrate north to Berkeley when I was 17, and I did see that as an immigration.
What did you want to be when you grew up?
No plans. No special plans.
What did you focus on at school?
I started out studying physical chemistry, sort of as a chemist, and in the physical sciences. I also took a lot of political science and political theory, and I painted.
That's an interesting mix of things.
Yeah, so that kind of mix has stayed with me my whole life, I think. So the sciences, technology, and then the arts.
Did the people signing you up for that roll their eyes at you, or was that a normal thing to do, a big mix of things like that?
Well, in a big place like Berkeley, as long as you were meeting your requirements, I don't think anyone paid too much attention to what you were doing. So you had a lot of freedom to do all kinds of things.
So was chemistry a particular interest or something you were good at? How did you get there?
Chemistry was something I got involved in high school and took an AP chemistry class, which I really loved. So I was sort of heading in that direction, kind of when I went to university.
And you mixed it with politics?
Mixed it with politics, political theory.
Where did that come from?
You know, who knows? Just interested in how people organize society and what's at stake with the choices we make and how we organize ourselves as a society.
Were you a political family?
No, not particularly.
Oh. It just somehow snuck in.
Just snuck in, yes. I mean, I just think I've always been, interested in what choices we make as a society, how we want to live our lives, what kind of society we want to live in, what kinds of tools we want to build, and those themes have just stuck with me all the way through.
What choices we make as a society, but one of the choices we've made is a pretty weird political system.
In what way do you see it as weird?
Well, if given all of the choices that we want to make in our lives, we reduce that down to essentially a binary, do you like this crowd or this crowd, The chances of all of the things that we want aligning with one or the other of those, I don't think it's a very high chance of that happening.
Right. But, you know, seeing us move from tribes and small clans and then this crazy idea about a nation state that people should somehow come together and coalesce at that level, and then these ideas of how people would move out of a feudal society to something that was more representative and I mean, that's rather remarkable to me. And now the ideas we have about internationalization, you know, the ideas about international law or United Nations, you know, where did that come from? And that people can think about and invent these sort of structures for how we would organize and negotiate and share power and share resources. So it doesn't mean that we're doing it perfectly or ideally, and in many ways we're not, but it is just fascinating to see about that and to see that we have so much choice in how we make, you know, these kinds of systems that we live in.
And you painted.
And
you
I
do
painted.
Paint.
And I do paint. Well, mostly for the last decade or so, I've been a sculptor. I'm a stone carver.
Wow. Well, where did that come from?
Where did that come from? So I guess I've always done some kind of art, and I've always loved stone. But probably about 10 years or so ago, I mean, I think stone is, for me at least, kind of intimidating. You know, it's a very strong medium. And I just decided I wanted to learn how to do it. So I took a course with a fellow in Seattle who's actually an Iraqi. And he was just a wonderful teacher. And I studied with him for about 7 or 8 years before eventually I just started going off on my own. And so I still carve.
What sort of scale are they?
Well, my last project were 4 stones that were bigger than myself. And they're tall pillars of limestone that used to be fence posts on the plains of Kansas. So they're pretty interesting stones. So Kansas had a very shallow sea. So there's shells in them, and they have their life when they were sort of the sea. And then because the plains don't have trees, I think in the 1800s, they would pop up pieces of this stone and use them as fence posts. And so they have cable running through them and bits of wire and all of that. And then I got them several years ago, and now I've carved them into something else. So they're called passages because they hold on to, you know, all of these different transformations.
In their current state, do they retain some of that history?
Yes. I mean, when I've kept in the stone, certainly you can see some of the fossils there, and then I've also kept some of the pieces of wire, and you can see some of the places where they had previously been drilled. So they're transformed, but they still carry some of the marks of their past lives.
Cool. And where are they?
One of them is here in Seattle, and 3 of them. I have a studio in Twisp, which is in the Mentau Valley. It's on the eastern side of the mountains in the Cascades, so part of an artist community and economic development area in a small town there.
Awesome.
Yeah, it is pretty exciting.
Does it take long?
Yes, I carve, right now, I carve with a tool, I carve by hand, and I carve with a tool that looks like a hammer, except instead of having a hammerhead, it has something that looks like a meat tenderizer. It has 9 points, and I just carve by tapping on the stone, and I can carve soft stones all the way through to, you know, you could carve marble, granite stones by that. So it's just a very slow process of just slowly tapping away, and eventually the forms emerge.
Do you look at a rock and see what it's inside it?
Yes, in a way, though I wouldn't describe it in that way. What I would say is I spend time with the stone, and then quite a lot of time, actually, before I even start carving it. And then I start tapping on it, and the forms kind of emerge sort of as you touch one part of the stone and change that, then the rest of the stone needs to be addressed in response to that change. So it isn't that I have an idea of what the end product will be. I don't, in that sense, I don't see something in the stone that I'm revealing, but it's through interacting with the stone and how it changes that the final form emerges. So the work that I do tends to be fairly organic, and also in some ways figurative or landscape. So the 3 tall stones that I have in Twisp, people have described it as when they spend time with the stones, it's sort of like spending time with other people. They have a person presence to them, even though they're abstract.
And they're still big, still person-sized.
Yes, or taller than me, for sure.
Cool. All right, so grad school.
Yes, grad school.
What did you do there?
Grad school. So
did you go straight there?
No, I finished. I did my undergrad at Berkeley, and then I had a job. Part of the way I put myself through school was by teaching in a science museum. I taught hands-on chemistry to 8 to 11-year-old kids. And that's where I first started experimenting with these notions about responsibility for the science and the technology that we do. And so one of the things, I mean, we were using household chemicals, but one of the things that we did in this science museum that was perched up in the hills, in the Berkeley Hills, with a beautiful view of the bay, as every week after kids did their experiments, we would collect their residue into this big beaker. And over the week, we would just see these materials build up. And I kept asking the kids, what are we going to do with it? And, you know, what are we going to do? Are we just going to pour that down the drain? And if we pour that down the drain, where is it going to go? And it was pretty easy to see. It was just going to go right down the hill and into the bay. And so we used that as a way to talk about the kinds of residues that we create when we do any kind of work, actually, in the world, and what our responsibilities are for those kinds of things. And when does justifying a certain kind of waste, you know, when is the work that we're doing, when does that justify the kind of waste that we generate? So that was work that I was doing, you know, when I was a college student. And then by the time I graduated, I actually graduated with a degree in computer science and got involved in computer science education. And similarly, started looking at issues around, or social and ethical issues that had to do with computing, and also how to bring those issues to the kids I was working with. So as an example of that, I might teach a class with 12 or 15 students, and we probably had 8 computers. And so in a more traditional setting, a teacher might decide how the students were going to share. But what I did was I flipped it around to the students and said, well, look, there's, you know, 14 or 15 of you, and we only have 8 machines. How are we going to share these? And the kids would come up with policies, and then we would vote on those, and we'd implement them, and then we'd reflect on them. So, for example, I recall one time where the kid said, well, let's have a relay race. We'll all start here and we'll run, and whoever gets the machine first can work alone, and then and we did that, and we found out that the boys ran faster than the girls. And so then we had a reflection on that policy. We lived with that for that class, and then the kids talked about why, well, maybe that wasn't so fair. And then we would try a new policy. And one time we had a situation where somebody was unhappy about something. I'm not quite sure what it was, but the kids said, well, so-and-so's having a really bad day. I think they should have their own machine. And so then the policies started to change as the kids saw what the policies were and what the implications or consequences were for this small community. You know, they began to take into account those sorts of things and how they wanted to allocate these resources that they were using. And it put in their hands control over this issue of resource allocation, and they were able to have their own conversations about what's fair, what's just, how do we create a caring society within our classroom around these kinds of resources? So those were some of the things I was doing in my early 20s.
Do you think those kids went home and explained that, and the parents said, why are we mucking around doing that? Why aren't there more computers? Do you think that the learning that was from that was appreciated? Firstly by the kids, but also by the parents.
Well, possibly if their parents even knew about it. I don't know if the kids went home and talked to them about it. But I think for the kids, the way in which it was appreciated is that there wasn't any whining about access to the technology. there was mature conversation about it, and the kids learned how to express what their needs were and what their desires were, and to listen and hear what other kids' needs and desires were.
So then you took that into your graduate studies?
I took that into my graduate studies. So I worked at the Science Museum, which was associated with Berkeley, for about 3 years. And then I decided I loved my job. I loved living in Berkeley. But I wanted to read some theory, and I wanted to learn some more. So I applied to a PhD program there. And it was a experimental PhD program. It was a floating group. It wasn't actually associated with any particular department around science education, and had been started by some mathematicians and physicists who thought that the problem with math and science education is that the people who were teaching were people who were trained in education and then tried to come up to speed in their field of science. So they wanted to flip it around. They wanted to take people who had sort of master's level expertise in their field of science and bring them up to speed with education. And so they were really leaders in a lot of the informal science education that we've come to see and expect in science museums today. So a lot of the hands-on kinds of exhibits came out of, some of the ideas for that came out of this community.
It's an interesting role that the science museums have created for themselves. I've spoken to several people in the last couple of years that from the science museum direction, and not only making an impact beyond the science and not just sort of seeing it as educating the kids that happen to be in the room, but actually having a much, much wider impact. I'm thinking of Tim Flannery, who wrote the Future Eaters and the Weather Makers, who was Australian of the Year a few years ago because of his sort of impact in science communication that he was doing as a curator of a museum, being the curator of mammals or something, and spending most of his time looking for rats in the Pacific Islands, but having a much, much wider impact. I don't think that's widely appreciated, the role of the museum. We've still got this sort of stuffy old institution model. Maybe we haven't. Maybe we just, maybe the sort of the cultural messaging around it hasn't caught up with what the museums are doing.
Well, and I think there's, you know, sort of the British Museum idea, the Smithsonian Museum idea, that we're, you know, you have lots of specimens that are saved and preserved at the museum. And then there's the exploratorium type museum, which is really hands-on exhibits that allow people to observe for themselves certain kinds of phenomena and try to stimulate discussion about the phenomena that they're observing. So there's a variety of different kinds of science museums, I think.
One of the things that I've been looking for and not finding particularly much of is systems thinking in science museums. There tends to be a reduction down to a simple sort of scientific principles. That, you know, the closer you can get to moving your elbow to learn about levers or whatever the relationship is, the better. And that doesn't play very nicely for teaching about the whole is greater than the sum of the parts type thinking. Have you come across any really good examples of from more complex levels of thinking in science museums?
Well, I guess I haven't been looking, but I haven't been looking, and I haven't been involved in science museums in several decades. But I think it's a really good question. I mean, people who come to science museums and they come with their kids, they're probably spending a very short amount of time interacting with any one exhibit. And systemic kinds of relationships usually take a bit more time to develop. So it might be more in science curriculum that is in the schools, or you know, projects where kids can go out and monitor, you know, they measure their rain and they measure the acidity of the rain and then they put it into an online system and make that data available to science or scientists, that kind of thing, or simulations where you can simulate infections and how they spread. But you're more likely to do that, I think, in a classroom than in a museum setting. It's a good point that you
And the relationship between that and values.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose there is, you know, there is a bit of sort of commentary in the museums about what, the sort of thing you're talking about before, the impact of this this sort of thing. Cool. Anyway, we're supposed to be talking about you. So, your thesis and your PhD?
My thesis. So I looked at the time I was doing my dissertation work, people were starting to use, there was a lot of software out there, there was a lot of copying of software going on. There were a lot of people saying that adolescents were completely losing their moral compass because they were copying software. So I did my dissertation looking at high school students and their ideas about privacy and property and how those ideas carried over to electronic information. The nugget, I would suppose, for my dissertation was that when you look at canonical things like, you know, stealing a bike or reading someone's diary, these adolescents had really clear ideas about ways in which people were harmed, and they didn't see that those things were okay. And when they moved over to electronic information, what happened is it wasn't so clear what the nature of the harms were. And depending upon how they interpreted the harms, that is how they interpreted what kinds of actions were all right to do or not all right to do. So, for example, some of the adolescents had the idea that software companies were charging. They assumed that you were going to make a certain number of copies, and they were actually charging for that. And so, therefore, in fact, not only were you entitled to make those copies, but if you didn't make them, then in some ways the software company was stealing money from you. And the students I spoke with were really quite clear. They all had different ideas about how many copies the companies had charged for. So for some people it was 3. For some people, who knows? It was a long time ago, 8. And if you made more copies than that, then in fact, then you were stealing from the software company. So I think it indicates that when we have new kinds of technologies and the conventions around them are not well understood, that at least the adolescents I spoke with fell back on what one would call moral reasoning. They were looking for ways in which there were harms, trying to identify the harms, or things that were unfair, and then they were coming up with a way for themselves to act in the world that was respectful of the harms that they understood. I think that we see that as new technologies roll out all the time, I think we see that same kind of thing playing out, where lots of different kinds of behaviors, and it takes a while for us to understand the nature of the harms. But once people do, then they try to make their judgments based on those.
Is there a direct line from that research to the value-sensitive design?
Well, yes, I think there is. That was probably the beginnings for me of some of that work, or maybe it even goes back to, back to when I was an undergrad teaching these, 8 to 11-year-olds. I think that for all of us, first of all, human beings, we're tool users. Fundamentally, we're tool users. And our tools are just a part of what we do. It's how we go about being in the world. So I don't think that there's a very harsh, strong delineation between an act that I take that's a non-tool use act and some that's a tool use act. In fact, I think we just act in the world, and we act with our tools. So, and as we act in the world, I think we ask ourselves these questions about am I hurting somebody by engaging in this action? Is this fair? What's the nature of justice? you know, am I building community? Am I being a good friend to somebody? I think these are, am I being generous? You know, these kinds of qualities are ways in which we want to be in the world, and I think that our technologies are just an integral part of that. So the issue isn't that there's technology or a tool there. The interesting moment is when we introduce a new technology that gives us a very different way of acting or being in the world, and we're unfamiliar with a lot of the ways in which it will intersect with all the other things that we're doing. We're sort of guessing at what the nature of the impacts will be, and it's a little bit unclear, you know. And these things, these tools, come into social systems, right? Social systems about what gets owned or what can't be owned, how it is that goods and services are going to be compensated for, what does it mean to share a piece of information, how widely will it be shared. And you don't know all of those things in the beginning. So people are sort of feeling their way around and perhaps surprised sometimes by the nature of the impacts. And then we slowly sort some of those things out.
To some extent, those new tools are by definition disruptive. And that's what the ones we celebrate, the Uber, Airbnb, and so on. Should we try and think what the impacts of those things are going to be before we do them? But by very nature, that's disruptive, and perhaps we can't. But should we be doing it anyway?
Well, this is it's a great question. I mean, in one sense, we can say about any of these technologies, tools, can we know what their ripple effects are going to be? And I think Hannah Arendt, made a strong statement that no, we can't. And I think that that's quite right. We don't know what the appropriations will be. And even if we anticipate the immediate appropriations, we don't know what the longer-term ripple effects will be. So you could, from that position, then say, well, then no need to worry about the values while we're designing the technologies because we don't know. One could make that argument. But
I suspect you don't.
I don't. I think we don't know. But my intuition is that by being conscious and intentional about some of the value implications, that we are more likely to have effects that are positive, or at least to avoid some really egregious negative effects. So let me just give you an example. An architect who's designing a building, if we design the building so that there are only stairs and no elevators and no ramps, then we can build buildings where people who are in wheelchairs can't get into the building. And if the activities in the building have to do with being able to vote in a society or being able to get educated or other kinds of social goods, then by virtue of building that building in that way, we've created conditions in which a segment of society can't access those social goods. And I think the parallel applies to information technology. So if we think from the beginning about designing our infrastructure, our information infrastructures, so that people who have, for example, limited vision or limited audio can access those things, then whatever kinds of goods and services and however that integrates with society, those people will have access to. And we don't have any guarantees. As designers and builders of technology, we don't control everything. So even going back to the building example, let's say that we build buildings that have ramps and elevators in them, but the people who are in that building, let's say it's an office space, decide they don't want to hire people in wheelchairs. Well, then those people aren't going to get jobs. So designers of technology don't control all of the aspects of how these technologies will be appropriated and used by society, but we do control some really important pieces. And I think if we don't attend to those, then inadvertently there may be negative consequences where if we had been attentive, we could have been proactive on something positive.
To what extent are values explicitly embodied in technology?
Yes, this is another really hard question, huh? Well, I think, like, here's an example. Your cell phone. Does your cell phone broadcast your information and your whereabouts? You know, you're walking down the shopping mall and the cell phone is saying, you know, here's Sam. Or is your cell phone have an architecture where it's listening and all the vendors are saying, you know, here's a deal, and your phone can listen to it and tell you about it? Well, one of those architectures is more easily privacy protecting of your location than the other. And so, you know, to say, is my cell phone, does it embody values in some ways? Well, yes, I think that the architecture of a technology makes certain things easier and other things harder, if not impossible. And so that's an example of an architecture that makes it either harder or easier to build in privacy-preserving kinds of features.
We might assume that privacy is a good value. We probably do. But there might be cases where it's not. I don't know if they are offhand, but let's pretend there are. So whose values do we get to embed?
Right, and so, you know, some of these things belong in the public sphere as part of discourse. So I'll give you an example where we might feel that privacy or confidentiality isn't such a good thing. So many in democratic societies, people believe that often that there are some kinds of information that should be part of the public domain. Right. So in the United States, for example, if you contribute to an election more than a certain amount to a campaign, then that information is part of the public domain. Cities often have a lot of public records. And the views on open government believe that those records should be transparent, that people should be able to examine them. So then the question arises, you know, historically the greatest protection of privacy was just the amount of effort that it would take. So most of these kinds of rules and practices, at least in the United States, evolved at a time where you would actually have to physically go down to a courthouse and look at these records if you thought something was amiss. But they were accessible to you so that you could be transparent and examine them if you thought that there was good need. Now there's a movement to put all of those records online, and so now from your house, with very minimal effort, you can search all of these records. So that balance between privacy and transparency, which is really a very delicate balance that was in place because of a certain kind of technology, that balance has been changed. And the question really for us as a society is, what sort of balance do we want between privacy and transparency? And then do we have put in place the technical infrastructure that allows us to experience the kind of balance that we think is beneficial for society?
Is balance a usual metaphor for thinking of these things? Is it, can we normally put things against, well, we're trading this one thing off against another thing? And I'm thinking when it gets slightly less tangible, when we start thinking about values, you've described calmness and dignity.
Mm-hmm.
Those are hard to put numbers against, which makes it harder to then think about them in terms of a balance.
Right. Well, I suppose by balance, or the way I tend to think about it, is more of a web. That that, you know, the values that we hold, we all hold a multiplicity of values, and they sit, I would say, in a delicate balance with each other, just like the strands of a spider web are in a delicate balance. And if you pick up on one value or you put tension in one place, it moves. All of the other values move with it. And so it's more that, you know, if you think of things like two things can be in tension and together they hold, that tension holds them up. So the tensions or these ways that they sit in relation to each other are the nature. It's just the nature of human life. And so the question is, how do we hold on to them? You know, if you take something like calmness, or you take something like, you know, the desire to be left alone. I both desire calmness and to be left alone, and also to be part of community. Also to be able to be responsive if somebody has a need or an emergency. So we hold, you know, we value all of those things simultaneously, and it's holding on to that, I think, is the design challenge.
How does technology support changing values as an individual level or as a societal level? The values that the society held in the 50s are very different to what we hold now.
Mm-hmm.
How are we avoiding technology ossifying this set of values?
Well, I guess I'm thinking about some of your work on sustainability. We might say that there might be a greater awareness now about limited resources on the planet than there was, say, in the 50s. And as there is greater awareness and perhaps looking for ways for individuals but also cities and infrastructure to change in response to that, we might develop new technologies to be able to be responsive to that. So, for example, if we could develop a new technology that generated lots of electricity with minimal resources from the planet, that would change the energy issues considerably, right? That would mean we can just keep consuming lots and lots, and there's just sort of no problem there, right, if we're clever in that direction. And if we're not clever in that direction, then maybe we need to move in a direction where we build fewer and fewer things that draw power, right? So we can, I think we can question, you know, in our community and in the computing community, there's a presumption about building widgets, more and more widgets, and all of these widgets, you know, how many microprocessors does each person have in their homes, and how many are they projected to have? And we can ask, is that actually sustainable? Is it sustainable in terms of just the raw resources, the metals that we're actually talking about? Is it sustainable in terms of the amount of power that we're talking about? We're building things now so that there's a presumption of 24/7 access to power and to the network. And increasingly, people are putting data and activities that are really critical to their lives into an infrastructure that needs to be on and functioning 24/7. You know, so if you are a diabetic, and the way that you know, the kinds of sensors you have on your body are going back to the net to figure out how much insulin you should have, and you have an embedded insulin pump and it's releasing insulin into your body, what happens if there's a brownout? You know, the kinds of dependencies that we're building in for health, for communication, for heating your home, you know, so we can ask how sensible are these.
So technology not only needs to embody values, it also brings with it its own values, the presumption of ubiquity. Is that a value?
Well, I mean, did the technology bring that? We created this idea about ubiquitous computing. We created this idea that we would have 24/7 an infrastructure that would be live 24/7, and that we would hook everything to that infrastructure. And we can question, I think we can question that. We can question on a number of levels. One level has to do with dependency, just on keeping it there. The other has to do with the amount of energy that's needed to sustain that. It has certain sorts of benefits, certain sorts of communication benefits, but it also has certain kinds of dependencies that maybe aren't always the smartest.
One of the key aspects of sustainability is intergenerational equity. And I know that you've done work in multi-lifespan information design. So what I want to know is, what can we learn from that work for wider lessons about sustainability?
Oh, that's a really great question. So the multi-lifespan work, just to recap on what that is starts with the premise there are certain categories of problems that we're unlikely to solve in a single human lifespan because of the nature of the problem. So it really goes to what kind of problem are we talking about? And so far we've identified three categories of problems. This is some work Lisa Nathan and I did. The first is about limitations of the human psyche. So, you know, if I've killed your babies, you've killed mine, what's the likelihood that we can create a lasting peace? Well, maybe we can agree to keep our children who are still alive alive, and maybe their children can grow up in an environment where they don't feel threatened, and maybe it's the third generation that can really build a peace. So what is it that the human psyche can actually do? The second category has to do with tears in the social fabric of society. So if HIV/AIDS wipes out, you know, a significant amount of the population between the ages of 20 and 50, all the work that that group of people does in knitting together the society and caring for the elderly, passing along knowledge, there's huge gaps. Or I think in China, the one child per family policy is a social policy that leads to a similar kind of change to the social fabric. And then the third category has to do with environmental issues, where environmental timelines may be just on a different scale, slower or faster than a human scale. And what we've been looking at is, you know, in our field, we tend to design something in 3 weeks to 6 months, deploy it for 18 months, and call it obsolete in 5 years. And here what we're saying is if we recognize that these problem solutions are going to unfold over longer periods of time, and there are roles and opportunities for information systems to help support those solutions as they unfold, then what should the design process be? How do we engage in this longer-term design thinking? If we're trying to bring stakeholders in, how do we help support longer-term design thinking for stakeholders so they can begin to express the concerns that they have, the visions that they have? And so we've been working on developing design methods to help support this longer-term thinking. And so now I've forgotten what your question was.
What can we learn from that for wider sustainability?
Oh, so I think that one of the things that I think that work is beginning to generate that can carry over to sustainability are some actual design methods. So when people are working on sustainability, the kinds of ways in which you can help somebody understand where their lifespan fits within a much longer lifespan, and what kinds of, if we're talking about environmental sustainability, what kinds of environmental issues and timelines are also at stake. So you can begin to see how decisions within your lifespan are going to affect and mesh with what might be going on at say, the environmental timeline. So putting those together is one kind of strategy. Another piece from that work that I think is useful is doing co-design, but where we support people doing co-design at a certain time in the future, like 20 or 40 years in the future, where they can then anticipate, well, if we continue in this way, this is what the environmental degradation might be like. So then what would it mean to actually design in those kinds of environmental conditions? So scaffolding that kind of design thinking, I think, can be quite helpful.
Because it's really difficult to get a person from 2050, a young city councillor, around the council table now.
Right.
Because they're not there. But they're the ones that are going to have to, you know, be dealing with the 20 years, which is still quite young, for the sewage system or whatever it is that you're putting into, let alone the 100-year lifespan that you're talking about for it.
Right. So, but I think if you have people now thinking about, here's what's happening with our sewage, here's the trajectory for it, and now 40 years out, we're trying to design, and what would be the, you brought up the issue of systemic effects, but what might be the systemic conditions in which we would then be trying to design 40 years out? And doing that kind of design work, I think, can bring people back to thinking about, well, what if we make some different choices now? So you may want to actually evaluate a variety of kinds of options in these different kinds of time frames.
What's the most exciting work you've done in the last couple of years?
I think the work on the Voices from the Rwanda Tribunal project, working on transitional justice and thinking about information systems to help support transitional justice, has been very, very meaningful work. And I have lots of questions about it, in how helpful or useful the work that we've done is. There's a lot to learn in a very complicated situation and a very contested history. And in some ways, we're the team that I work with. We're outside of the Rwandan conflict, so there's that relationship of being outsiders. At the same time, I think that we as citizens of the world care about these notions about international justice. And in the same way that systems of democracy were just getting started, you know, a few hundred years ago, now we're at a place where systems of international justice are just being developed. We're really at the very beginnings of that. So it sort of circles back to that conversation about interest in social and political systems and how we build them, and seeing the nature of ideas change over time. So, you know, in my lifetime, if you had asked me in my 20s or 30s if I would have ever seen apartheid fall in South Africa, if I would ever have seen widespread recycling in the United States and ban on smoking, I would have said no. I wouldn't have believed any of those things could have happened. So I think that on the one hand, sometimes we can be really discouraged about where and how it is our societies are evolving. In certain ways, we can also point to places of real progress. And that's important, I think, to hold on to, and to realize that when we identify huge problems, we really can make change. And then the change takes a long time. So, you know, ending apartheid in South Africa doesn't mean that there is complete justice there. Doesn't mean that all the problems are solved, that you know, there's still huge problems. Ending slavery in the U.S. was a huge thing, and yet in the United States we still have huge issues around race and around economic justice and educational justice. But we can begin, you know, we begin to make these inroads, these changes.
You talked a while about science education, and that leads me to think about, are we doing it wrong in terms of our educational and our research? We're teaching people about very sort of short-term experimental, you know, identify a problem, do an intervention, measure it, and write it up. And the problems that you're talking about last a long time. And, you know, the work in Rwanda, which has enormous intrinsic value, but maybe the important message is that we do need to focus on the hard stuff. And we shouldn't be shirking away from this just because it's a hugely complex system that's not amenable to a simple intervention, measure it and write a PhD and get out. So you are taking on the hard stuff.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it in that way, but I agree with you. I mean, I think the most important thing is to work on the things that you think really matter. You know, and not to be afraid of failure. You know, at many, many stages in my career along the lines of the work I've done, people have told me that just can't be done. And my response to that, and perhaps it's just the way in which I think and work, has been not so much to argue with any words, but to take that skepticism seriously, and then to go build something, a proof of concept. But to build an artifact or to build a method that responds to and shows that it can be done, you know. And so then the question goes away. And so for me, that's become a very useful or successful strategy for trying to make progress or inroads. So in the same way where, you know, I think if you had asked me 8 years ago about the transitional project in Rwanda, is it possible? Could you do something? I don't know that I could have answered that question, but by starting the work and then slowly doing the work as best one can, with eyes open or trying to have eyes open to all the complexities, then I think over time one has a proof of concept about how one could make some progress. But I think working on the problems that really matter is really important. I mean, you could spend your life working on things that you know you can solve, but if you and others don't really care about their problems, maybe that's not the best way to spend your time. And if you work on something you really care about, even if it's hard and you fail or you don't make progress, at least you know you're working on something that really matters.
I think particularly, even if you don't know how you're going to solve it, if we knew how we were going to solve it, that would be easy.
Right. Well, and I think for myself, I mean, I know that I would recommend this for everyone. For myself, if failure wasn't, in other words, if I knew that I could succeed, if failure wasn't an actual possibility, it probably, for me, doesn't meet the criteria of a problem to work on. But that may just be personal style. And I do think that there are things that really matter to us that don't necessarily have, where we know we can do better, so don't necessarily have that particular criteria. But it has tended to characterize a lot of the work that I've done. So I think I've learned a lot about how to work on the technical problems that I do through the stone carving that I've done, and that to me has been really quite interesting. So when you carve, at least the way I carve, one of the things is that you need to carve in 360 degrees. You have to carve all the way around. So you're always walking around your piece, and you can never see the whole piece at a single moment. But ultimately, for a piece to work, all the bits have to resolve together. And I think that has given me some skill in being able to dive into really complex, as you say, systemic kinds of issues where you can work on a little bit of one piece of it, and then you walk around to another piece of it, and another piece of it, and another piece of it, and you're continually working the whole without ever at any moment being able to see the whole. And perhaps it's just working with the stone has made me feel comfortable with that amount of ambiguity and visibility to something. It's also the case that when I carve, I don't know what the resolution will be. And I feel comfortable with that. So I don't need to go into a project knowing where it's going to end or what it will look like in the end. I think that one can use principles and be adaptive in the goals, and as you move into the project, you understand better what the next move will be. And so I find that as a process for myself, successful. I think that if I were to try to prescribe things, the solutions would end up being brittle. So it's a way of working that's very emergent.
We're writing a book of these interviews. It's likely to be called Tomorrow's Heroes. So we're looking at people that are doing work now. We can talk whether or not people consider themselves to be heroes, but that's what we're calling it. and trying to identify the particular things that they're doing. So how would you like us to describe your sustainable superpower? And you're not allowed to say faster than a speeding train, stops bullets, laser eyes.
So I think if I were to say what I think my special talent is, I think some of it, has to do with a systemic thinking and approach, that it is organic and in some way spatial or visual, and listening. You know, when I carve, I listen to the stone. When I'm doing research, I listen to the context, to the situation, to technically what is there, and wait until I know how to act. You know, so I think another thing that I think is crucial is time. And as with a stone, you walk around the stone and you might not touch it. Sometimes I don't touch the stone for a long time because I don't understand what the next act is. And the same is with research. You know, that we can be designing a system and we don't know yet what the right next thing to do is. And so we wait and something changes. Something changes in the social context. Something changes in the technical infrastructure. And then the next step seems clearer and we can take it. So somehow that kind of approach...
I asked a similar question before, but I'm going to answer it again because then you get a free hit. What's the biggest success you've had in the last couple of years?
I don't think the work that I'm doing anymore is special or unique. I mean, 20, 25 years ago when I started working on values and technology, even to say that was startling to people. And people just said that you can't do that. How do you do? You know, it was just... the end of the conversations right there. Now, if you look at, and it's not just in human-computer interaction, it's not just at CHI, but you go to AI and you go to big data and all of this, everyone is talking about, at one level, the intersection between values and the technologies that we're building and how to embed those things. And so... if anything, it was just to be an early part of that conversation and perhaps to have created some of the early proof of concepts that enabled other people to say that they too could do that kind of work. And so now I think it's very mainstream.
Do you consider yourself to be an activist?
This is another great question. I don't think of myself as an activist in the traditional way, but I am beginning to think of myself as a public intellectual and wondering about playing that role. I would like to participate more in a public conversation about what kinds of science and technology we should be engaging in. And I think that... I would like us to be more thoughtful about which technology... You know, we don't build out and invest in building out every technology. We make choices. And how are we making those choices? What technologies are we going forward with? What kinds of society do we want to live in? What should those investments be?
Some of the work in this field mm-hmm. is on the edge. Lisa Nathan's work in Canada, the Indigenous... Indigenous
First Nation. Okay, I'll answer that question for you. So I think what you're saying is, you know, do I tend to work on the margins? And I think the answer to that is yes. I mean, when I first started doing work with values and technology, as I mentioned, there wasn't any work pretty much like that. And people thought it couldn't be done. So... at that time, that was work very much on the margins. And as that work has built up, and then, as you say, the multi-lifespan work, I think also pushed the margins. So, I think there is a way in which looking at where we are and then what are the next hard, as you say, what are the next really hard questions, but also socially and ethically important questions for us to engage in with respect to our tool use and infrastructure building. And those are the long-term themes that I've been engaging with. So as the society moves forward, as we learn more, as the field grows and develops, then where those boundaries are, where we need to be doing new work, changes in positive ways. And and participating on those edges and those questions is an exciting place to be.
What motivates you? What gets you out of bed in the morning?
The sunshine. each day, curiosity about the day. Again, in a very deep way, I really am not a very goal-oriented person. I know it's a surprise, but I don't really have big goals.
So this next question might be interesting to answer then. What's the biggest challenge you're looking forward to in the next couple of years?
Well, it's actually an interesting crossroads for me in a really interesting way. In some ways, you need time to pursue different sorts of things. So I guess I always wonder if I want to take the vast amount of my time and put it into art and build some really big things. I have some ideas about some big things, big stones and pieces of metal and other kinds of things, other kinds of media and other kinds of expression that I would like to explore. And then I think there are, pushing on some of the multi-lifespan work into other arenas, I think could be very, very important. I mentioned the idea about being a public intellectual. I'm not quite sure what that means, but I think there's a kind of public conversation to be had, and that I might be able to contribute to that in helpful ways. And that would require expression through different kinds of media and modes of expression. And that could be a lot of fun, I think. And it could be through theater, it could be through animation, it could be through, lyrics of songs, it could be through artifacts that people can play with, it could be through, op-ed pieces, all kinds of stories, that could be really useful.
I agree entirely. That's why I'm making a movie. If you could wave a magic wand and have a miracle occur tomorrow morning, what would you like to happen?
Peace.
Lastly, I'm just going to leave that at that. That's such a good idea. What's the smallest thing that we could do that would have the biggest impact to get us there? That's not my last question. That's an add-on.
Sleep. No, I mean that fairly seriously. I think that a lot of the aggressions and microaggressions, when people are really exhausted or sleep deprived, they get cranky. One little thing, one nudge gets somebody else, people flare, aggressions follow. So in a very serious way, I think that if everyone on the planet could just get a good night's sleep on the same night and we were to all reset, that actually something like that would be quite huge for peace and smoothing over of social conflict. So I mean that in a very serious way.
And maybe you've just answered this question as well then. Do you have any advice for our listeners?
Well, yes, get a good night's sleep. No, it's true. I do think I would really say slow down. Slow down in your life. It's both getting a lot of sleep and also waking up in the morning without an agenda and just opening your eyes and looking at the world and what it's offering, and then take that opportunity. I think that our society is so goal-directed that we don't see what's in front of us. We miss all, we're so busy going to where we're going that we miss the very thing that's in front of us that would be available to us. So just, yes, get a good night's sleep, wake up in the morning and just open your eyes and pay attention to what's right there.
Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. On sustainablelens.org, we're building up a searchable archive of conversations with people from many different fields who are applying their skills to a sustainable future. In our conversations, we're trying to find out what motivates them and what it means to see the world through a sustainable perspective, through their sustainable lens. Tonight's sustainable lens was that of Professor Batya Friedman from the University of Washington Information School. You can follow the links on Sustainable Lens to find us on Facebook, and you can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes for free. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann. I hope you enjoyed the show.